This morning we're going to talk about that oil spill in Louisiana. What does it mean to Minnesota? And this is Minnesota This Week, a public affairs program from Radio City Network News. And this station, I'm Curtis Beckman. Our guest this morning is David Morris, who is Vice President of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Good morning to you, Mr. Morris.
Good morning.
We found you through Bob Moffat at the Lung Association. I called him and I said, is there someone in the Twin Cities who is particularly conversant on the issues of oil and oil drilling and who could tell my audience what that oil spill is going to do to us? And people can tell hearing the sounds that this is being recorded on Wednesday, first Wednesday of the month. We practice tornadoes. So, Mr. Morris, you have done research in these areas. You've been involved in oil policy for quite a while. Explain where you're coming from as you have.
Right. Well, I've been involved in looking at oil and looking at energy since the first oil embargo and the spike of energy prices in 1974. Most people that are listening were either not alive at that point, or they were so young that they probably
don't remember the lines of cars at the gas station.
That's right. The lines of cars and the price of oil went up by 400%. Mm-hmm. 400%. Let's think of that. And then in 1979, with the hostage situation and the basically shortage of oil, there was a doubling of oil prices again. So the price of oil went up eightfold between 1974 and 1979, and that was a period in which I and many other people began to say, is there a way to get us off this this treadmill of oil, and began to look at other solutions.
It seems unfair. Were those situations in the 70s unfair to us?
Well, unfair. I mean, let's understand what happened in 1974 was that OPEC, which is the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, which had been formed in the 1960s, and we fomented its formation, interestingly enough. Their coming out party was in 1974, actually late 1973, and it was around the Israeli war, the Yom Kippur War. And so they essentially put a boycott on countries that supported Israel. So it was unfair, but actually it was the countries that did that, not the oil companies. In 1979, there was actually a 5% shortage of oil internationally because of what was going on in Iran. And that sounds like a very small amount, but frankly, because of the margins, it doubled the oil price. So in both of those cases, one can argue that there are circumstances. I mean, there's an international oil trading system. Now, in 2008, so sort of bringing you up to date, we saw the price of oil go berserk.
Yeah,
and the price of oil went from $40 a barrel to $150 a barrel within about 5 months. And that was a situation where Goldman Sachs was behind that, not Exxon.
Right.
Although Exxon loved the idea of what was happening, but it was commodity speculation that drove those prices high. And as soon as the speculators got out of the market, it dropped in half.
Yeah. So that was unfair. On its face.
Well, it's always unfair. It's always unfair.
Yes.
It's unfair in the sense that we have someone, if you will, manipulating the situation to their own advantage and to the detriment of the world economy.
The business of taking oil from the ground and making gasoline from it and other petroleum products has been controversial from the start. Good Lord, we saw movies about the discovery of oil in Texas when it came spewing out of these derricks and made millionaires out of people in Texas and Oklahoma and such. And so we had a young auto industry then that just went gangbusters and saw to it that every American family had a car to burn this gasoline that came from that oil that was so plentiful. It's not so plentiful anymore, or at least it's expensive to get.
Well, yes, and when we think about those movies, like Giant, is the wonderful movie in the 1950s, when they discovered oil, they drilled down a few feet, and the oil spurted out.
Yeah.
It was just sort of this gusher that happened. And then they had to drill down a few hundred feet, and then they had to drill down a few thousand feet. And now we're in offshore drilling, which is the Gulf of Mexico, essentially, and offshore drilling is the new frontier for oil, in which you drill down as much as 8 miles. 8 miles, right. You drill down, well, in this case, it was a mile down to the seabed, and then it was about 3 miles below the seabed, but the world record right now is 8 miles in total going down.
What was that, a valley for the dinosaurs or something millions and billions of years ago?
Well, it's probably not enough time in this episode to talk about that. But there are two theories about how oil was created. And one of the theories, which of course everybody knows about, is that there were dinosaurs, although frankly it was plant matter, it wasn't animal matter, and that they decayed, and they decayed at a time where there wasn't the bacteria around to essentially decompose them, and so they stayed fairly solid, and then over a million years of pressure, they became fossil fuels. That's why we call them fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. In fact, a plant that you grow is called a carbohydrate, because it has carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. And under pressure, the oxygen disappears, and you have carbon and hydrogen. And that's a reason why it's such an extraordinary energy source, because it's so compressed that a gallon of gasoline has four times more energy than does the comparable amount of wood, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the theories.
Yeah.
Another theory is what's called the abiotic theory of oil, which is essentially that oil is produced in the magma under the crust of the earth, and it's produced from the carbon underneath the earth under enormous pressure and then pushed upward from that. And then where there are cracks, they come upward. Now, that's a school of thought which is a very, very minor school of thought, but it's not a crackpot school of thought. There's a lot of scientists that are interested in that, and they think that their school of thought has been proven now. Mm-hmm. Because of this offshore drilling. Because their theory was always, look, you've got to go down 6 or 8 miles. And the industry was saying, we're not going down 6 or 8 miles to prove your theory. That's crazy. Well, now we're down 6 to 8 miles. And they say, well, this is obviously not oil that was down there because of dinosaurs dying. That's crazy.
Right.
Right? It had to be something that's coming up from below. So there's a whole new theory that's occurring about how oil was created.
That's fascinating in itself. Do we know how much oil we have left, how much we have consumed? What are the ratios here? Are we dangerously close to being out of oil, or haven't we even pricked the surface yet?
Well, that's in some ways the $64,000 question, but we know how much oil we've consumed fairly well. We can count. In terms of how much oil is available out there, you have different categories of estimates. So you have potential reserves, you have recoverable reserves, you have economic recoverable reserves. So, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico, that's not economical unless the price of oil is more than $70, $75 a barrel.
Not economical to go down 8 miles to get
correct.
It.
Correct.
Okay.
And which is why a lot of them closed down about a year ago. Now they're back up again. And oil for most of our history was below $20 a barrel. That issue is, in terms of economically recoverable, some people say, well, if it went to $150 a barrel, which it was, a year and a half ago, there'd be an enormous more oil that might be available. But essentially, what people are saying is, we are either at what's called peak oil, or we will be there within 10 or 15 years. And what they mean by peak oil means that the growing demand meets the not-so-fast-growing supply, and at some point we peak. That is, at some point the supply does not increase at the rate that the demand is increasing. And for the last 6 or 7 years...
Which means someday we'll run out.
Exactly. But in terms of running out, to predict the date that we run out is not important.
Right.
But to predict the date that we begin to decline is important, because at the point where we begin to run out, the point in which every year we consume more than we increase the supply, and suddenly your prices get out of hand, not through speculation, but just through supply and demand. So it's an important discussion, and frankly, it's a discussion that is occurring at the very highest levels. And so far, everyone, a month ago, the Pentagon signed on to it, that peak oil they think will be about 2015.
Wow. That's close.
Very close.
That's close. We see the oil coming out of this well that was 8 miles deep, as you say, and it is besmirching the shores of Louisiana or very near to it. If oil is naturally occurring, does it finally get absorbed or resorbed by the water? Is it finally not a threat to the environment, or is it always a threat and we always have to clean up as much as we can?
Oh yeah, it's always a threat to the environment. Always a threat to the environment. By the way, it's not 8 miles is the record. One is about 3 miles deep. But you know, you asked sort of earlier, how does this affect Minnesota? Minnesota gets our oil essentially from Canada, mainly because we're very close to Canada, and it comes down into Minnesota around Duluth, and much of that oil now, maybe 60% of that oil, is from the tar sands. It's called tar sands oil, which is literally oil, sand that has oil in it. And that was not economical to recover.
It is now.
And it's the fastest growing part of the oil supply in Canada. And Canada is the largest exporter of oil to the United States, not Saudi Arabia, not Algeria, but Canada. And a lot of it comes in through Minnesota. So in terms of our direct impact, the oil spill is not going to reach Minnesota, number mm-hmm. one, and we get our oil from Canada. However, in terms of the indirect impact, it is very significant. First of all, because that oil could reach the Mississippi River.
Which oil?
The oil spill.
Okay.
And if the oil spill reaches the Mississippi River, then we're talking about traffic on the Mississippi River being probably not stopped, but they have to clean off the hulls and so slow down. So you have this enormous traffic jam down in the bottom of Louisiana. And, of course, we have a lot of economy up here in Minnesota that is based on traffic on the Mississippi River. So that's one thing. The second thing is that if that oil spill continues, and most people say it's going to continue for at least a few more weeks and possibly a few more months, that it could spread to Florida, and then it is in the Gulf Stream, which means it will go around Florida and up the East Coast. And up the East Coast, and you were talking about hundreds of billions of dollars in damage.
Yeah.
Now, who's going to pay for that? Well, we know who's going to pay for that. The federal government is going to pay for that. And so it becomes a deficit issue. And once again, Minnesota is hit by something that Minnesota didn't do, but
right.
is clearly going to be an impact.
If it got that far, is it visible? Do we smell it? Do we taste it?
Oh, yes.
All of those things?
Yes. Well, there's right now there's a what's called a sheen of oil, which is a number of miles away from the coast, but that's what's moving toward the coast. And then there's the thicker oil. You know, when the Valdez tanker split, that was thick oil. That was really crude oil. This is less crude oil, which is good in many
because
ways. Well, it's good because because it's a sheen, because you can clean it up and you can stop it and you can use detergents, you know, on it, all of which they're doing. Now the question is, can you do it at a rate that actually stops it from expanding?
Do we soak it up to clean it up?
Well, there are booms that soak it up. Yes, that's one of the things you can do. More than that is that they use detergents just the way you use detergents in the kitchen, on soap and the like, and which actually breaks it up, breaks
change
the molecule
the composition
up.
Of
right.
the oil.
And so that will allow it to just go back into the water. But the, you know, once again, the big question here is, can they stop it, you know, from spewing out? And right now they are thinking of ways to do it. But the ways that they're thinking of doing it have never been done before.
That's that big bell thing
right,
that goes
exactly,
on top?
Exactly. They've never done it at that depth. We're talking about a mile down in water itself. A mile down in water, you don't get deep sea divers that go down there.
Right.
You've got to have little submersibles that go down there. So this is really quite, quite something.
Mm-hmm. And so that's ongoing. That's for them down there, it could impact on the Mississippi River and the commerce that Minnesota depends on there. We're getting our oil from Canada through the pipelines that come straight down here and goes out to the Pine Bend refinery and others and beyond. And so we don't really have a problem with that, but we do. Is that problem there going to impact on oil prices and gasoline prices here?
It already is.
The gasoline that I put in my vehicle. And how can that be?
Well, because oil is an internationally traded commodity. In the same way of corn. I mean, let's think about it in Minnesota corn times. Right. In Minnesota corn got planted very early this year because of the weather. It's an extraordinary year for farmers planting corn. And because of that, the price of corn went down because people expect that there's going to be a bumper crop, more supply, and so the price goes down because corn is an internationally traded commodity. Well, in the case of oil, when Hurricane Katrina hit, you had a lot of rigs that went down in the Gulf of Oil, which meant you might have had 3 or 4% of the oil that's used in the United States that suddenly was offline, and prices spiked during that period of time. So it does affect us in terms of supply and demand. It also affects us if the oil companies begin to think that maybe they're going to have to be liable for these kind of spills. The oil companies are very powerful politically.
Yeah. And so do you or does anyone project, can you project on the impact here and how much prices may go up? What have you heard about the prices and the level that might be reached because of this problem?
Well, I haven't heard of anything, but what we can see is that the prices just went up in the last couple of days when the price of crude oil went down.
What does that mean?
Well, that means that somebody along the chain is raising your price, and it means that essentially the crude oil price, you would think, sets the price for your gasoline, and normally it does. But there's also the refiner's price, there's the distributor's price, and in many cases those are different companies. And so a number of them may be, in fact, raising the price now, you know, artificially. But if there's a problem in the supply of oil, even if it's just a hiccup, then you can expect the oil prices to go up. And I would, you know, the only wild card in all of this stuff is that there's a world economy which is still collapsing, which means demand is going down.
Right.
So normally this hiccup, it would seem to me, would have at least a $10 or $20 increase in the price of oil, which translates into about a 60-cent increase in your price of gasoline per gallon. But because your economy is so sluggish right now, then it isn't exactly clear what the direct correlation is in 2010.
How should we regard, we, the public, Joe Blow, how should we consider or evaluate the oil industry when it rationalizes its increases in prices by saying we have all this great new demand from China, this new demand from India, and the Russians do or do not drill for the oil that they have because they don't know how to do it. How should we regard those causes or reasons that the oil industry cites as reasons for increasing prices?
Well, you know, what they try to do is maximize their profit. Exxon in 2008 made more profits than any company in world history. And by the way, paid virtually no taxes on that.
It's worse.
They will make as much of a profit as they can. But at the same time, it is true that China is increasing dramatically its consumption of oil. So we can rail all we want, but what we can do effectively is to switch from gasoline
just to get out of
to
it.
Electricity,
yeah,
and have electric cars, because electricity is produced domestically from domestic fuels, and we will no longer be at the mercy of oil companies, hurricanes, or oil rigs.
Our guest this morning is David Morris, who is vice president of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and this is Minnesota This Week, a public affairs program from Radio City Network News. And this station, I'm Curtis Beckman. We are smart, aren't we, to just get out of oil if we can. Can we ever do that, though?
Well, sure we can do that. The reason that it will take time is that we're so dependent on it.
Should we have started way back then?
We should have started in 1974.
Right.
We forget that in 1974 we had a Project Blueprint Independence. Now, this was Richard Nixon going on Gerry Ford, because Richard Nixon resigned in August of 1974. But essentially the government said our major mission is to get us off oil. And then Jimmy Carter came in, and he said that he would get us off oil by 1990, and this was 1976. Well, in 1974, the United States was about 23% or so dependent on imported oil. Today, we're 65% dependent on imported oil. So, yes, we've had 40 years of very good warning to do it, and we've gone in the wrong direction. We are now, for the first time, going in the right direction in terms of fuel efficiency standards for cars, in terms of ethanol, in terms of electric vehicles, but we've wasted almost 40 years.
Yes. The mix there, we have to have that mix of energy sources, don't we, to fuel the cars. I mean, we can't do it all. We can't change it all with ethanol. We can't change it all with electricity. We've got to have a little bit of everything to overcome this addiction to oil, don't we?
Well, initially one does, yes, although electricity, frankly, could displace it completely. But when you start talking about, well, how would you do that? Let's say you had, you know, enough electric vehicles tomorrow. Well, people don't buy them tomorrow, and then you turn over
right.
and keep your car for 6 years. So it's going to take us at least 20 or 25 years to get off, let's say, half or 75% of oil. On the other hand, if we start today, and if it looks like we're making a dent, then you're going to see oil prices come down, and you're going to see a very different dynamic occur in the world economy. Right now, oil demand is still increasing.
Yeah. How will they ever solve the battery problem and get us a decent battery that is small enough to fit these cars and let us go for 500 miles before we need another one?
Well, they actually have. And so we will have electric vehicles introduced. This is mass market electric vehicles introduced this fall by three manufacturers. Unfortunately, none of them U.S. manufacturers, but nevertheless, some of them will be made in the United States. So they have solved that problem. Not 500 miles, no. But, you know, Americans have to grow up. You don't drive your car 500 miles before you fill up in gasoline. And number
right.
two, 99% of the time you drive your car, you drive it for about 5 or 10 miles, period. And if you had a charger where you ended up, like in the commuter parking lot or the like, you'd be just fine. So in essence, what we need probably is 100 miles. And these cars are going to have 100 miles of range. The batteries are still expensive, but we're talking about a new industry here. So one would expect the batteries
right.
to still be expensive.
Are they rechargeable batteries? Or,
yes.
They're
all rechargeable batteries. You couldn't operate otherwise,
right.
of course.
You can't throw away your
right.
Well, your
the battery that we have, the lead-acid battery, is a rechargeable battery.
Yeah.
And, in fact, it is extremely cheap.
It's always recharging.
That's right. 98% of the lead is recycled. It's a wonderful battery, and it's lasted us for very long. The problem is that it doesn't have the capacity to drive an electric vehicle. It's used to drive the radio. It's used to drive, you know, the electrical spark plug and so forth. But we need different kinds of batteries for electric vehicles.
So we're going to get there. It's going to take a generation, but we're going to get that boost this fall, I suppose. If these prices go high enough now, artificially or however they're judged to be, if those prices go high enough now, we're going to buy more of those cars in the fall, aren't we?
Well, yes, and a matter of policy, they could. You know, in Europe after 1974, the way they dealt with the oil crisis is that they imposed a tax on gasoline that was twice the cost of gasoline. So right now, gasoline and diesel cost between $4 and $5 a gallon in Europe, with about more than half of that going to taxes, which pay for mass transit, taxes that pay for Social Security,
right.
and the like. Whereas what we haven't raised our federal gas tax in, I think, 15 years. And in Minnesota, we'd spent 5 years, and there were three governmental vetoes in order to raise it by a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Americans, you know, frankly, are not approaching this issue in any sort of coherent way. We like to scream, but the
in
solution,
any progressive way,
I call it coherent way. Frankly, you know, if you wanted to get off oil, then how do you do that? Well, you raise the price of oil. And the best way to raise the price of oil is to do it yourself and to recycle that money back to you, you know, rather than to scream about how they're raising the price of oil.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to me to be a policy that would work.
We've got 5 minutes left. This has been just fascinating so far. But in the last few minutes here, let's talk about your organization, Institute for Local Self-Reliance. What's that all about? We are in an office near the University of Minnesota. You are a scholar, if anything. And what's your organization all about? What have you done? Where can we see your work?
Well, you can see our work on our website, newrules, one word, .org, and you can, you know, we publish everything we know, and so in that sense, we are naked.
This is good.
We are naked before you. In terms of what we do, our philosophy is that you can solve most of the world's problems from the bottom up, and should. And that even though at the top, meaning large corporations or federal governments or international, you know, policies, you can establish good policies, but they'll only get implemented at the local level and at the state level. And at the local level, when you develop a policy, you can develop it not as a matter of consensus, but with everybody being involved in the decision-making, so it really has a legitimacy. Whereas if it comes
and
down...
And a strength.
Yes.
Then, when everybody is doing it, there's nobody... catcalling there, the people who are participating, everybody's participating, the change is there.
That's right. You know, people can grumble, but they were part of the process. And the other thing is that new technologies are decentralizing in their impact. You know, when we shifted from wood to steel, we shifted from small to big. When we shifted from wind power to electric, to coal-generated electricity, we shifted from small to centralized. Now, when we shift backwards, you know, to renewables, when we shift toward smaller manufacturing, toward plastics and the like, we are more decentralizing. The internet is more decentralizing. So given that, what we're saying is let's look at the world's problems from the bottom up and see how many we can solve within an area that we feel comfortable in.
The bottom up, that means we should not try to get the electricity from the windmills in the southwestern Minnesota to the Twin Cities?
No, that's okay, except that we shouldn't try to get the electricity from the windmills in western North Dakota. And part of what the Institute does is try to fight these high-voltage transmission lines, which, in fact, Minnesota approved, that will take the electricity from North Dakota to Chicago and simply go across Minnesota, but will not actually have any off-ramps or on-ramps, and so we will not be able to use that electricity. So, yes, even renewable electricity we need to think about from the bottom up.
And how to get it here? How can you do that? Why can't they do it today?
They can do it today. They can do it today.
You can get the power generated from those windmills and Pipestone to the Twin Cities.
Yes, it is.
Just put it into the grid? Is that it?
Put it into the grid. It is coming into the grid right now. Okay. The grid has a great deal of capacity. Now, it may not have the capacity to give us 30% or 40% of our electricity, but we're still trying to figure out what that means. You know, we've got solar, you know, on rooftops. We've got electric vehicles. And you know what electric vehicle is? It's a consumer of electricity. It's a storer of electricity. And it's a generator of electricity. It's a whole new creature. You know, you think of it as a car, but it sits there. And it could be backup power for your house. If you got solar on your roof, that electricity can be put into the battery of the car and stored in case you need it later. So there are things happening out there, and rather than build new high voltage transmission lines that go 10,000, that go 3,000 or 4,000 miles, one should think seriously about what kind of scale and structure we want of our future electricity system.
On balance, then, in the last minute, what's going on there in the Gulf of Mexico with that oil spill? It might be just the trigger we need to hasten the day when we all come to an electric car.
Well, one would hope. One would hope that it has its shock value. You know, here we have a foreign company. This is an American oil company. It's a British oil company.
But they own Amoco, don't they?
And you have an accident which could have potentially catastrophic, you know, impacts. And so one hopes that it's a wake-up call that will be translated into action and not simply rhetoric.
On that note, we end. Our guest this morning has been David Morris, Vice President of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And that website again?
Is newrules1word.org.
David Morris, thank you very much for being with us this morning. We'll do it more later.
Thank you.
And this is Minnesota This Week, a public affairs program from Radio City, Network News, and this station. I'm Curtis Beckman. We'd like your comment. Please write to Minnesota This Week in care of this station, or write to Minnesota This Week, Radio City Network News, Post Office Box 390292, Minneapolis, Minnesota 55439. Thank you, and good morning.